Smart Eyewear Highlight, sponsored by Innovative Eyewear, developer and provider of cutting-edge Lucid Bluetooth glasses. Lucid Smart Eyewear is multifunctional, meeting the needs of the optical, hearable, and digital assistant markets. Innovative Eyewear. NASDAQ trading symbol LUCY. Lucy. Web address lucyd.co.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. ESG, ESG investing, dominating the conversation in the financial world, because right now the concern is, are we doing enough to prevent climate change? Disastrous climate change is the challenge. Recently, an event called a Moral Money Summit in London featured a speaker, Stuart Kirk of HSBC Asset Management. He's the head, or was the head, of responsible investing. Mr. Kirk has a sense of humor that was not appreciated at this conference. One remark, and it's hard to believe that somebody wouldn't regard this as funny. There's always some nut job telling me about the end of the world. For that, Mr. Kirk was chastised and relieved of his post and is now not heard from regularly. But it's just a few weeks, and so what he will do is make a return and explain to us what it is to be head of responsible investing at a major bank. However, I have Terry Anderson of the Hoover Institution to turn to, because Terry anticipated all this in a book that he published recently, Adapt and Be Adept. In here are essays by chiefly economists, but also commentators on such abstract things as fire insurance for wildfires in California, talking about the planet we have, not the planet we want to have. And the planet we have has limits. Those limits are uncomfortable, and sometimes they're even not acceptable to be talked about in public, such as at an ESG meeting or a moral money summit. One of those limitations I learned from an essay by Mark Mills is that hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, are here forever. Terry, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much for joining. We've talked about your book over this last year. You published it in the spring of 21. But apparently there is still some doubt about the fact of hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, and some doubt about the limits of renewables, wind and solar and battery power, to store that energy when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. In general, we've talked also about Mr. Kirk's presentation. What is it that he said that so upset some of the participants, for example, Christiana Figueres of the United Nations climate chief? She said that Mr. Kirk's remarks, quote, one of the most irresponsible public statements we have heard in years. What did he say that set them off? And what do we need to learn from Mark Mills? Good evening to you, Terry.
Good evening, John. I think the answer is in the first word of that summit, moral. These are people who think they have the moral high ground being that we are here to save the world from climate change, and that it is our responsibility to ensure that not just the government, but certainly to force that they're induce the government to make investments in what are called climate responsible activities, but for the private sector to do the same, because it's the morally right thing to do. I remember a discussion with Milton Friedman about should firms worry about paying the just wage, or any, if he were alive today, we could talk about ESG. And he made it clear the job of a firm is to make a profit. And that doesn't have any moral implications to it. It's just make a profit and do the accounting to do so. What's going on today with climate change is the people who think that business has a moral responsibility to take on climate change are forcing investments that don't make economic sense, that aren't profitable, and are hurting the investors. And I think what happened is Mr. Kirk just called them on it.
The Mark Mills essay has some hard facts. These are specifics. We're going to get a little geeky here, Terry, because we're not speaking in generalities the way some of these very well-meaning representatives are of ESG investing. This fact jumps out at me again and again. Wind-powered and sunlight-energized machines, hence these the windmills and the solar panels. Wind-powered and sunlight-energized machines produce energy averaged over a year about 25 to 30% of the time, often less. Okay, that's a fact. Good. What do you do with that energy to store it, to use it when they're not producing energy? That's battery authority or battery technology. But then there's this fact, Terry, and it stayed with me all the time since we first talked about your book. With batteries, it costs roughly $200 to store the energy equivalent of one barrel of oil. Terry, that's a physical limit, I believe. Isn't that what we're talking about? It's not like we're being difficult or cranky about this. That's a limit, and there's no solution to it as of now.
Well, I think the key words in what you just said are as of now, and those are the words that people pick up on and say, yes, but if we just get the private sector and government investing enough in the technology of battery storage, for example, that we won't stay as of now, we'll move forward. And no doubt we will. And it won't require a moral authority to do this. The fact of the matter is we are a species that likes to tinker and invent things. And we've been improving battery power for a long, long time and will continue to. But there's just nothing realistic in anybody's crystal ball that would suggest we can store so much battery power at low enough prices that we can possibly make solar or wind a viable alternative to hydrocarbons. And that's really Mark Mill's point. We'll improve. It'll get so that we're storing it for $150 a barrel. But eventually, we're going to run into the fact that we just can't continue to pour money down this rat hole.
To completely replace hydrocarbons, writes Mr. Mills, over the next 20 years, between now and the middle of the century, global renewable energy production would have to increase by at least 90-fold. Terry, that's not imaginable.
No, we just can't possibly do it. I just drove through Nevada and route back from the Hoover Institution, Stanford to Montana, and saw some relatively large solar farms. And you try to imagine what it would take to get to 90% of our power produced by solar farms, and we saw big wind farms as well. At some point, even the environmentalists would start to say this is a blight on the environment. It's just not realistic, and that's why hydrocarbons are here to stay.
The point also made by Mr. Mills is that 98% of the vehicles that move right now on Earth are driven by fossil fuels. At the best case of converting some of those vehicles to electric base, and there are problems there, we'll explore it. But in any event, if everybody gets issued a Tesla or its equivalent, we're still looking at the best case of build-out. We're still looking at 80% of the vehicles on Earth driving fossil fuels. So what we have here is the imaginable future for us, Terry. We're senior citizens, but also for our children and our children's children, is that fossil fuel is part of the matrix. It's not to be banished. I feel sometimes when I'm reading this that I'm up against abolitionists, and you know they're abolitionists have a way of carrying an argument with their fervor.
And that's what Mr. Kirk ran into, is that fervor. The notion that we can abolish oil is just, again, just not even imaginable if we want to continue the way we live today. Sure, we could stop burning fossil fuel and stop driving all these cars and live in huts in the woods. But people are not going to do that again, just because the human species is one that wants to move forward. And the only way we're going to move forward is to recognize the necessity of fossil fuels. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at alternative energy, and it doesn't mean we won't make great progress in those areas. But between now and that great progress, we're going to use fossil fuels. And I think it's important to add that the cost of doing so, it pales in comparison to the economic growth that's expected to occur in the next 100 years. By the end of the century, the estimates are that we will reduce our GDP at that point by 5%. But we will have grown by such a huge amount by then that the amount by which we'll reduce GDP makes we wouldn't even notice it. You or I could reach in our pocket and pull out the change and it wouldn't come close to affecting us the way it wouldn't come close. It would be about like the reductions in GDP if we continue with global warming. It's just not that big a deal in the foreseeable future.
You make a fine point, Terry, in the course of your essay to introduce this and then the body of work by the economists and observers, that climate change has monetization. We can monetize climate change, and some of it has to do with crop yields, with shipping costs, and with fewer deaths due to cold weather as opposed to warm weather. That is not now part of the discussion. Should it be, Terry, or are we being outliers?
It absolutely should be, and it is the morally responsible thing to introduce, in my opinion. I've been asked to participate in a lawsuit against the state of Montana filed by young people saying that the state's policies are going to ruin the environment. And a report was filed on their behalf that looks at the costs, and it says, oh, the costs far exceed the benefits of using the oil. But it doesn't mention any of the things you just mentioned. And the biggest one of all is the reduction in human deaths due to climate. And most people will say, oh, well, it gets hotter, we're going to lose more people. No, cold is what kills. And the result is that if we continue to have climate change, we will save people's lives simply because it's a warmer place to live. And that doesn't begin to address things like greater crop yields. But it's clear that the planet is greening, and it's greening in part because plants love CO2 and they're sucking it in and turning the planet greener. These are things that get left out of the discussion and out of the equations and out of the estimates of what are the effects of climate change that I think are again, important in the investment world. So back to Mr. Kirk, if you add those into investments, you have to think about investing in the positive parts of climate change. And Mr. Kirk was making that point.
I'm speaking with Terry Anderson, who is the editor of a book I recommend to ESG investors. The book is Adapt and Be Adept. Market response to climate change. And when we come back, I mentioned about batteries. There is a downside to batteries that is right in front of us. And it is difficult to solve by just saying we'll develop better technology. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.